This Week with George Stephanopoulos starts right now.
All-out war. As Russia expands its assault on Ukraine, President Zelensky appeals to Congress.
Being the leader of the world means to be the leader of peace.
President Biden confronts China, condemns Putin.
I think he is a war criminal.
What more will Russia do to avoid defeat?
We believe that Moscow may be setting the stage to use a chemical weapon.
An apartment block struck by a missile.
Ian Panel is live in Kyiv this morning, plus top Senate Democrat Dick Durbin and GOP conference chair John Barrasso. Courageous protest. Russian TV journalist Marina Ovsyannikova defies Putin, denounces the war. She joins us this morning in her first American broadcast interview. And
we're not done with this pandemic.
Cases of the new Omicron variant surge across Europe.
We do anticipate it may become the predominant variant in the weeks ahead.
Is the U.S. in for another COVID wave? Dr. Anthony Fauci joins us live. Plus all the week's politics on our Powerhouse Roundtable.
From ABC News, it's This Week. Here now, George Stephanopoulos.
Good morning and welcome to This Week. As we come on the air this morning, the war in Ukraine appears to be a stalemate. The Institute for the Study of War has concluded that Ukraine has defeated the initial Russian campaign, with forces stalled outside Kyiv and other major cities. But in the face of resistance, Putin is escalating his brutal attacks, drawing new charges of war crimes. President Zelensky is both promising victory and pleading for direct peace talks with Putin. The war enters its fourth week with more killing and more questions. No clarity at all on how the conflict ends or what the ultimate cost will be. Our senior foreign correspondent Ian Panel starts us off from Kyiv, which could soon face the biggest urban battle since World War II. Good morning, Ian.
Yeah, good morning, George. It has been another week of death, destruction and displacement in Ukraine. In the south and east, there have been some small Russian advances and many cities are encircled and they're being heavily bombarded. I think Mariupol in particular appears to be at risk of falling. But in many other areas, Putin's land invasion appears to have largely stalled for now. And in his hubris, he seems to have totally underestimated his enemy and overestimated the power of his own military.
25 days since Russia launched its invasion of Ukraine, and Putin's war is running into trouble. Suffering heavy losses and stalled operations on all fronts, Russian troops spent the fourth week of their offensive targeting military infrastructure and densely populated residential areas with increasingly heavy aerial bombardment. Civilians pummeled by Russian missiles day after day, with more than 3 million Ukrainians now refugees, half of them children. Tatiana and her one-year-old baby were in bed when their apartment block in Kyiv was blown up this week. I heard a very powerful explosion. My baby started yelling. I've never heard a cry like that, she says. I looked up and saw a huge fireball. I grabbed my baby and ran.
This is exactly what indiscriminate Russian bombardment actually looks like. An apartment block struck by a missile at 5 a.m. and you can see the incredible damage that it's done.
Ukrainian officials confirming 23 killed outside of Kharkiv Thursday. The bombs aimed at a school and community center. 10 people were killed just standing in line for bread in the northern city of Chernihiv, according to the governor there. But it's the besieged city of Mariupol that's been the hardest hit. Russian bombs razing this drama theater to the ground. More than 1,000 people were sheltering there, and the word children was clearly written in Russian on the ground. Amid the setbacks around Kyiv, Russian forces have made small advances in eastern and southern Ukraine.
It says something very strong about how the Ukrainians are defending their territory and how weak the Russians are and how ineffective their air force has been.
Volodymyr Zelensky taking his role as a wartime president in an extraordinary appeal to the U.S. Congress.
Remember Pearl Harbor. Remember September the 11th, when evil tried to turn your cities, independent territories, in battlefields. Our country experiences the same every day.
Within hours, Biden unveiling $800 million worth of new military aid to Ukraine, a $1 billion total in just 1 week. for the first time, President Biden offering his harshest assessment yet.
He is a war criminal.
Will you be dealing with this?
In Moscow, though, it's another reality. Vladimir Putin on Friday staging a mass pro-war rally in Moscow. This week he claimed the invasion is unfolding successfully, but the costs are mounting for Putin. The Russian president acknowledging rising costs, rising inflation and unemployment. And although ceasefire negotiations continued this week, there are mixed signals as to how much they're achieving. The fear is that without a workable off-ramp, Putin may double down and turn to even more extreme steps.
We believe that Moscow may be setting the stage to use a chemical weapon and then falsely blame Ukraine to justify escalating its attacks on the Ukrainian people.
Next week, the president traveling to Belgium for a NATO summit where he and world leaders will discuss the ongoing conflict. The risks of other nations being drawn in are growing, and the week ahead feels a critical and dangerous moment in Putin's war in Ukraine.
Well, given how badly this campaign has gone, it does raise a question of whether Putin is prepared to moderate his war goals. But there was nothing in those speeches that he made this week to suggest he's at that point yet. And given the deployment of these longer-range missiles and ever more destructive and indiscriminate firepower, this is starting to look like it could become a protracted war of attrition. George?
Ian, panel, thanks very much. Let's bring in the Senate Democratic Whip now, Dick Durbin. Senator Durbin, thank you for joining us this morning. You just heard Ian, panel, right there. Putin shows no signs of backing down, at least at this point. What more can the U.S. do to put pressure on him?
Well, I might add that Ukraine has shown no signs of backing down either, and the United States, through our president and NATO alliance, are totally committed to this Ukrainian effort to stop Putin. The desperate things that he's doing now, killing innocent civilians and children, for goodness sakes, he will have a stained name in history forever for this.
Well, you say we're totally committed, but as you know, President Biden and the West have ruled out a no-fly zone for right now. Several of your Democratic colleagues have called for sending these MiG-29s, these fighter jets, to Ukraine. They say that's going to give the Ukrainians a chance at a fair fight without significant risk of escalation. But you've been resisting that. Why are they wrong?
Well, I can just tell you that we're asking for one-third of the Polish Air Force to be sent into Ukraine. The people of Poland, of course, want to make certain that they're safe. They're only a few miles away from the devastation that's going on in Ukraine. There are other ways for us to provide surface-to-air missiles and air defenses that will keep the Russians at bay in terms of their aerial attack. I think there are ways to do that that are consistent with the NATO alliance and would not jeopardize expanding this into World War III or even worse.
How about tougher economic sanctions right now, not only on Russia, but also potentially for China? We know that President Biden spoke with President Xi on Friday. It doesn't appear that China, at least not yet, is ready to back off their support for Putin.
President Xi has to decide his place in history and China's place in the world. If they are going to be part of Putin and his barbaric conduct in Ukraine, he's going to run the risk of discrediting his own nation. He has to think twice about that. And I think the president's most recent communication really put it on the line to him that if he is going to secretly say he's not taking a position and then quietly go ahead and provide the resources that Putin needs, we're going to know it and we're going to report it.
One of the things we've seen at home recently is, of course, inflation, higher gas prices across the board. President Biden has said that the sanctions on Putin are at least part of the issue there for causing the rise in the prices. But our next guest, Senator Barrasso, has taken that on. I want you to listen.
Biden would rather turn to dictators like those in Iran and those in Venezuela rather than turn against the climate elitists who dictate the energy policy of that Democrat Party and of his presidency. So now he's trying to pass the buck to Vladimir Putin.
What's your response?
Well, I'll tell you, it's hard to deny that what we're doing, cutting off Russian sources of oil, won't have some impact on the United States. But President Biden and his supporters are trying to find every way to reduce the impact of that. Governors are suspending their state sales taxes on gas. There's conversation at the federal level as to how we can help families. But I think it is just completely wrong for us to blame President Biden and his efforts to stop Putin and say that these are the reason why we're having inflation in this country. There are many other factors. Other countries are going through the same inflation. We've got to make sure that we're sensible not only about Putin, the war, and his Russian oil supplies, but also sensible in what my friend John Barrasso calls these climate elitists. We are fighting and waging a war against climate change. It is a war which will decide what the American look, the world looks like for the next generation. Let's take both of these very seriously.
Finally, you're also chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson's confirmation hearings are set to begin. In the face of those hearings, we are now seeing escalating attacks from some Senate Republicans like Josh Hawley, who set out a Twitter series of tweets suggesting that Judge Jackson is somehow soft on child porn. It's been debunked by several independent fact checkers. But what does that tell you about the confirmation fight ahead?
Well, I'm not sure what it signals, but as far as Senator Hawley is concerned, here's the bottom line. He's wrong. He's inaccurate and unfair in his analysis. Judge Jackson has been scrutinized more than any person I can think of. This is her fourth time before the Senate Judiciary Committee. And three previous times, she came through with flying colors and bipartisan support, the last time as soon as just last year. And now Senator Hawley is making these charges that came out of nowhere. The independent fact checkers like the Washington Post and CNN have discredited his claims already. They should have. There's no truth to what he says. And he's part of a fringe within the Republican Party. This was the man who was fist bumping the murderous mob that descended on the Capitol on January 6th of last year. He doesn't have the credibility he thinks he does.
Senator Durbin, thanks for your time this morning. Let's bring in Senator John Barrasso right now. Senator Barrasso, I do want to begin where Senator Durbin just left off in those attacks from Senator Hawley this week. You met with Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson earlier this week, and you said, you didn't say suggest how you were going to vote, but you said this should not be a process of character assassination. Is that what Senator Hawley was doing?
Well, these hearings are going to, and the whole process is going to be fair, respectful, and thorough. I did meet with her, clearly very intelligent. We talked about judicial philosophy. I talked about Justice Scalia, that it's the Constitution, a legal document, not a living document. We had a very good meeting. I'm less concerned about her statements than I am about Chuck Schumer's statements. He said she's going to rule with empathy. A judge ought to be making decisions based on the law as written, not the way they feel about it. So he also said, check her record. And going through the record, there are some concerns that people have about her being perceived as soft on crime. That's all going to come out with the hearings, but they're going to be respectful, they're going to be thorough, and they're going to be fair, George.
But do you think Senator Hawley's attacks were fair?
Well, he's going to have his opportunity to question the judge, as will all of the members of the committee. The last time we had a hearing with Kavanaugh, he was accused of being a serial rapist on no evidence whatsoever. So I think that we're going to have a fair process and a respectful process, unlike what the Democrats did to Justice Kavanaugh.
You also heard Senator Durbin on gas prices and inflation. Right there, he said it's clearly President Putin has to bear some of the blame. And he took on your comment about a climate elitist saying we have to take climate change seriously. Is he wrong about that?
Well, Joe Biden can't hide from the fact that he is the president of high gas prices, and they're looking for anyone to blame, whether it's Putin, whether it's Republicans, whether it's the energy companies, whether it's COVID. The Democrats have a very big problem with 40-year high inflation, highest gas prices ever. When Joe Biden came into office, it was $2.38 a gallon for gasoline. American families paid $1,000 more, George, for energy last year than the year before. And on polling last week, 70% of Americans say more American oil and gas and less emphasis on climate.
Let's talk about the war in Ukraine. What should the United States be doing right now that it's not doing?
Well, first, you just had Senator Durbin on. He and I were in Ukraine together in 2014, the day that Russia took Crimea. There's a bipartisan group of senators right now at the border between Poland and Ukraine. There is a bipartisan committed group in Washington, committed to helping the heroic people of Ukraine, so proud of President Zelensky and the courage that he has shown. And in Congress, we are trying to get the administration on board to a level that we feel we've filled the void in a bipartisan way. The president has had to be pushed and pulled to where he is today. It was Congress that brought about sanctions, that brought about the ban on Russian oil, that brought about weapons, and all of this big aid package that I voted for a week or two ago, $13 billion. So far, the administration has only released $1 billion of that. And if, as president, I think if they'd done more in sanctions, we might not have been in this situation if they had done punishing sanctions before the tanks began to roll. President Biden is going to NATO this week. He's going to NATO this week, and if he wants to lead from the front, and America lead from the front, rather than leading from behind, there are three specific things he needs to do, in my opinion, at NATO this week.
What are the three specific things?
Well, number one is he needs to tell NATO that we collectively are going to supply the people of Ukraine things that they know how to use, whether it's drones, planes, missile systems. Number two, he has to say that he is going to go from Brussels to the Eastern Front of NATO to show the resolve of NATO and the United States' commitment as well. And third, he needs to say to the people of Europe who are really in a tough situation with regard to energy and the dependence that they have on Russian energy, that we are going to increase the exporting of liquefied natural gas from America to them. Even Germany has come up to the fact that they said, look, energy security, George, is much more important than climate zealotry. The president needs to lead by saying we're going to increase production of oil and natural gas in the United States. We're going to send it to you. And that's what leadership is all about. I have legislation in a bipartisan way to make that possible.
Senator Barrasso, thanks very much for your time this morning.
Thank you, George.
Coming up, the Russian television editor who risked her life to denounce the war. Maria Ovsyannikova joins us for her first American broadcast interview next.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
That is Russian television producer Maria Ovsyannikova defying Vladimir Putin during the evening news on state television with a powerful and courageous plea for peace. She joins us now from Moscow for her first American broadcast interview. Marina, thank you so much for joining us this morning. With that act of defiance, you now face the prospect of years in prison. You put your life in danger. What compelled you to take that risk?
First of all, I want to say, everyone, the Russian people are really against the war. It's Putin's war, not Russian people's war. And I want to speak Russian language because Russian is a great language of Pushkin and Tolstoy. То, что касается этого протеста,
This protest, you know, was a spontaneous decision for me to go out live on air. But the dissatisfaction with the current situation has been accumulating for many years, because the propaganda on our state channels was becoming more and more distorted, and the pressure that has been applied in the Russian politics could not leave us indifferent. When I spoke to my friends and colleagues, everyone until the last moment could not believe that such a thing could happen, that this gruesome war could take place. And as soon as the war began, I could not eat, I could not sleep. I came to work, and after a week of coverage of this situation, the atmosphere on the first channel was so unpleasant that I realized that I could not go back there. I could see what in reality was happening in Ukraine. And what we showed on our programs was very different from what was going on in reality. And my first decision was to go to Manezhnaya Square and participate in the protests. But I could see that at that time, the new law was adopted that could mean criminal persecution of protests. And I could see security dragging people away from these protests and putting them in jail. And I decided that this was going to be a rather useless action on my part. And I decided that maybe I could do something else, something more meaningful, with more impact, where I could attract more attention to this. And I could show to the rest of the world that Russians are against the war. And I could show to the Russian people that this is just propaganda. Expose this propaganda for what it is, and maybe stimulate some people to speak up against the war. And I was hoping that my performance, in a way, would help people change their mind.
You've rejected France's offer of asylum. Are you not worried for the safety of yourself, of your two children?
I am very worried for the safety of my children, first and foremost. And I'm very grateful to Mr. Macron for his offer, but I have publicly refused to take political asylum in France because I am a patriot. I want to live in Russia. My children want to live in Russia. We had a very comfortable life in Russia, and I don't want to immigrate and lose another 10 years of my life to assimilate in some other country. And now, I believe, in the history of my country, the times are very dark and very difficult, and every person who has a civil position, who wants to make that civil position known, must speak up. It's very important.
What is your message for President Putin? What is your message for the West?
With this action, I wanted to demonstrate to the world that not all Russian people believe the same. And I believe that many people, more than half of the people in Russia, are against the war. And the severe sanctions that the West is imposing on all of the people is probably a correct decision, but you must understand that not just the oligarchs and Putin's closest circle are suffering from these sanctions. Ordinary people, ordinary Russian citizens who are against the war are also being affected. And the first people who suffered from this actually were our 11-year-old daughter, who was whose credit card was blocked, and she couldn't have lunch at school. She couldn't pay for her lunch at school and was hungry. So I just wanted to show to the world that it's not just black and white in Russia. And I wanted to show to our Russian people that they need to think critically and analyze the information that is being presented to them critically.
Well, your act of bravery has resonated all over the world. Thank you for joining us this morning. Please stay safe.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
What we're seeing with BA2 is not really any more severe disease, not any more immune evasion than we saw with the original Omicron. We do see that it is a bit more transmissible. And so we're following this very carefully. We might expect, as we open up as well, as we relax many of our mitigation strategies, that we may have some increase in cases.
Dr. Rochelle Walensky right there. And with most of the country relaxing COVID restrictions, a new Omicron surge in Western Europe is raising alarm bells. We'll speak with Dr. Anthony Fauci about the potential for a new COVID wave in the U.S. after this analysis from Nate Silver of 538.
When it comes to COVID, what happens in England generally doesn't stay in England. The UK is currently experiencing a big spike in COVID cases, which have more than doubled from late February. When that's happened in the past, it's usually translated to more cases in the United States, too. Both the Delta and the Omicron waves hit the UK a couple of weeks before besieging the US, for example. Why the increase? Well, epidemiologists think it reflects some combination of the BA2 variant of Omicron, which is about 50% more transmissible, plus waning immunity, plus people relaxing their behavior as they try to achieve more normality. We have the same risk factors here. Moreover, only about 30% of Americans have had an additional booster dose of vaccine, as compared to 60% of UK residents. With that said, I don't think we should take this to be inevitable either. South Africa, which had an incredibly severe Omicron wave in December, has not seen another increase in cases so far. And although most European countries, such as Germany, Italy, and France, have seen an increase in spread, there are some exceptions like Spain. And about 45% of Americans are estimated to have already had Omicron. So if the US does avoid another spike, it frankly may just be because the first Omicron wave hit us so hard. On balance, I think I buy the U.S. is likely to see another increase in cases, if not from BA2 now, then from another variant later. As always, the best way to manage that uncertainty is to get vaccinated and boosted.
Thanks to Nate Silver for that. Let's bring in President Biden's chief medical advisor, Dr. Anthony Fauci. Dr. Fauci, thanks for coming back on This Week This Morning. You just heard Nate's perspective right there, fairly balanced. What's your take on this BA2 variant?
Well, as was said, it has a degree of transmission advantage over the original Omicron, but not multifold advantage. So it's about 50 to 60% or so more transmissible, which means ultimately over time, it might take over as the dominant variant. Clearly throughout the world, it's about 80+% 85% of the isolate. In the United States, it's still somewhere around 30%. So it does have an increased transmission capability. However, when you look at the cases, they do not appear to be any more severe, and they do not appear to evade immune responses, either from vaccines or prior infection. So the bottom line is we likely will see an uptick in cases, as we've seen in the European countries, particularly the UK, where they've had the same situation as we've had now. They have the BA2. They have a relaxation of some of the restrictions, such as indoor masking, and there's a waning of immunity. Hopefully, we won't see a surge. I don't think we will. The easiest way to prevent that is to continue to get people vaccinated, and for those who have been vaccinated, to continue to get them boosted. So that's really where we stand right now. We can expect to see an increase, yes.
We've seen this relaxation of restrictions all across the country right now. Any reason to reverse that?
I don't think so, George, not right now. I don't see us going back into any more really very strict kinds of restrictions, but you always have to have the flexibility. Remember when the CDC came out with the modification of their metrics, which would lead to the guidelines of what regions or counties in the country should have a masking indoor, they made it very clear that as you pull back on restrictions, if we do see a significant surge, particularly one that might result in increased hospitalizations, we have to be prepared to pivot and perhaps reinstitute some of those restrictions. But right now, at this point, George, I don't see that.
How should we be taking advantage of this moment right now? I was struck by something Anne Ramoyne, a UCLA epidemiologist, told the New York Times this morning, who said we've been wearing rose-colored glasses instead of correcting our vision. Her point is that we should be much more proactive. Does she have a point? What more can we be doing to protect against another surge?
Well, I think she makes a very, very good point. I mean, we only still have about 65% of our population has been vaccinated, and of the total population. And of those who are eligible for a booster, only about 50% of them have been boosted. There are a lot of things that we can do from a public health standpoint. The other thing we can do, and I hope that we get the funding from the Congress to do this, is to continue to build up our supply of antivirals, of tests, and of the ability to give boosts. I mean, we have a number of clinical trials going that are trying to determine what the best combination of boosting is to get both effectiveness and durability. So we just can't stand still, particularly as we appear to be in somewhat of a lull in the cases, where cases continue to come down, deaths continue to come down, and hospitalizations. That's no time at all to declare victory, because this virus has fooled us before, and we really must be prepared for the possibility that we might get another variant, and we don't want to be caught flat-footed on that.
Dr. Ashish Jha is going to be the president's new COVID coordinator, replacing Jeffrey Zients. He's never worked in government before, as you've pointed out. What advice do you have for him, and what's the most important thing he needs to do?
Well, first of all, he's a very competent person. I mean, he's been involved in this, not in the government, but from the outside. He's an experienced public health person. I think just to get to know the ropes in the government and coming from outside the government into the government, but he's going to have a lot of help, a lot of encouragement, a lot of collegiality from people like myself, from Dr. Walensky, from Dr. Murthy and others. So I think he's going to be just fine.
You know, you've said you're going to stay in this job until we get out of the pandemic phase. Of course, you've been serving your country now for decades. Are we approaching the point where we are past the pandemic phase and you'll go get some rest?
I'm not so sure, George. I want to make sure we're really out of this before I really seriously consider doing anything different. We're still in this. We have a way to go. I think we're clearly going in the right direction. I hope we stay that way.
Dr. Fauci, thanks as always for your time and your information.
Thank you.
To date, never has an African-American woman come before the Judiciary Committee for consideration to this highest court. Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson will be the very first.
President Biden is deliberately working to make the whole federal judiciary softer on crime. If any judicial nominee really does have special empathy for some parties over others, that's not an asset. It's a problem.
Senate leaders ahead of the confirmation hearings this week. That's one of the things we're going to talk about on our roundtable, joined by Chris Christie, Donna Brazile, our chief Washington correspondent, John Carl, and congressional correspondent, Rachel Scott. And I do want to get to that, but let's start with Ukraine. What a moment, Rachel, this week you're up there on Capitol Hill when President Zelensky addressed that joint session of Congress.
A rare address and a rare moment of unity, I think, on Capitol Hill. Lawmakers were not only moved by his words, but also that graphic video that he played. Senator Joni Ernst said it made her want to put on a uniform and go over there and help. And I think that Congress has actually been really effective in responding to a lot of these pleas from President Zelensky. Originally, it was $6 billion for humanitarian and military aid. That doubled to nearly $14 billion. We saw Democrats and Republicans put some pressure, as Senator John Barrasso mentioned, on the White House on that ban on Russian energy. But still, the no-fly zone, despite those pleas from Zelensky, that's just a line that they're just not willing to cross.
The new fight over planes.
Absolutely. By the way, regarding that speech, I spoke to one member of the Democratic leadership who said that he was so moved and so emotionally drained by what he heard and watching that video that he actually had to cancel meetings that he had later in the afternoon. I think it really, in a way, radicalized the Congress. So maybe no-fly zone, no American-enforced no-fly zone. But, you know, this idea of supplying the Polish MiGs and backfilling them with F-16s, there is overwhelming support for that Democratic and Republican in Congress. And if that were to come for a vote, which is something Lindsey Graham has tried to make happen, you would see Biden may oppose it, but overwhelmingly Democrats would support it.
Chris, there does seem to be some tension inside the Republican Party between this desire, as Rachel was pointing out, for unity and kind of a reflex of blaming President Biden.
Yeah, look, and I think that's always going to occur when you're with the party out of power, right? You're not sure which way to turn. You're on the substance here. I think what we need to be doing is being united and have a clear and consistent message with Democrats, if we can, on the issue of these MiGs, which I think John's right. I think you would see an overwhelming bipartisan vote to be able to do that. So I think if we stay to substantive issues, but if they're going to assess the president's leadership style, that's where things are going to diverge. So I think for Republicans, what they want to do is keep talking about what can we do to help Ukraine? Where are the lines? What are we willing to go up to but not cross? I think you'll find a lot of unity among Republicans and Democrats on that. If you start getting into assessing the performance of any particular player, whether it's Joe Biden or Mitch McConnell, you'll see Democrats separating with Republicans.
Well, I'm wearing the Ukrainian colors, and I think all Americans are standing with the Ukrainian people. This is a moment for not just our country and being unified, but it's a moment for the world to understand what it means to protect and strengthen and support the rule of law. The president has been incredible at unifying NATO, our European allies, and he didn't just start this week or last month when Russia invaded. He started last year and bringing the team back together and making sure that NATO understands that the United States will have their back. I think the administration must continue to show leadership on the humanitarian side, including handling the refugees who want to come to America. But we also, I believe, next week has to continue to apply pressure not just on Russia, but on China, but make sure that our European allies and the Ukrainian people know that we're going to provide as much assistance as possible. That's important.
It's hard to see if any of this is going to make a difference to Vladimir Putin so far, John. Clearly, the war not going as he expected. We saw that analysis this morning, that he's basically lost the first phase of the war. That could mean that we're in a far more dangerous phase right now.
It sure could. And really, if you look at this, George, we're in a Cold War, a new Cold War that has been waged for a long time. I mean, it wasn't just this invasion. It wasn't just Putin coming in and invading and taking Crimea. It was the invasion of Georgia. It was the way he has gone after his political opponents, both on Russian soil, but also poisonings that were done in the United Kingdom. And he has done all of this, not to mention his support for Assad and the leveling of the city of Aleppo. He has managed to do all of that without any consequences. This time, there have clearly been consequences. The Russian losses are serious. They are sustained. But George, there's no way that Putin simply backs away from this. He has put everything down here, and if his back is against the wall, Lord, I mean, the concern among the U.S. National security officials I've spoken to is that he turns to something devastating, a chemical attack, a biological attack, maybe something worse.
In the face of this brutality, Rachel, remarkable to see that Russian journalist on the air again this morning, facing all kinds of threats, not afraid to speak out.
Isn't it extraordinary to hear the words from her, to see the resilience from her? I mean, what a moment that was. And you think about the threat to her life, the threat to her safety, the crackdown that is going on, where you can't even say the word war. You can't even say the word invasion. And to see her come out with that bravery and defiance is just extraordinary.
In the end, Chris, that may be what can turn Putin around. She said the Russian people are against the war. Who knows what they know about the war at this point? But only that, perhaps, could be the pressure on him that causes him to reverse.
I think there's another thing, George. I think the guy who's really in a bind this morning is President Xi. So he's encouraged this. He's encouraged this to happen, but he didn't want to get too hot. He doesn't want him to take that next step. You know, if you're Xi, you don't want biological or chemical attack. You don't want tactical or battlefield nuclear weapons to be used, because he knows the result of that will be the rest of the world will not only unite against Russia, but against those who are supporting them, like China. So if you're President Xi this morning, you are walking the thinnest of tightropes with Putin. You don't want to get rid of Putin because, let's face it, he's the neighbor. He can count on him to be the despot like Xi is. But on the other hand, if Putin is as desperate as John claims that he is, and that members of our intelligence community claim that he is, and he is going to resort to that, Xi is, I would be confident, if he's smart, is going to get on the phone with Putin and say, not too fast, cowboy, because if you do that, I'm out of here. And if China leaves Russia, Russia's finished.
When you look at the readouts of that phone call between President Xi and President Biden, though, on Friday, it seemed like President Xi was pretty impervious after 2 hours of hearing from President Biden.
No, I mean, he's not going to move the needle right now. He's still trying to maintain his so-called neutrality. There's no neutrality in this battle. There's no neutrality when you are bombing maternity home. There's no neutrality when you're using bombs to kill people who are trying to flee. No, I think China is making a grave mistake in this battle, because this is really a battle of right versus wrong. Really, it's really good versus evil. And if China continues to play this so-called, we're just going to wait it out and call for diplomacy without putting some skin in the game, I think the United States...
Look, it's worse than what you're saying, right? He's not neutral. He's with Putin. He's helping Putin. And so what he's trying to do is disguise it with rhetoric that's saying he's neutral, offering himself to be a mediator. You know, that's like Biden saying he wants to mediate between, you know, Russia and Ukraine. We're not neutral. We're with Ukraine. And we should be. But Xi is trying to hide here. And what I'm saying is, if this escalates, there's going to be no place left to hide.
Right now, we're standing behind President Zelensky, John Carl. But at some point, if this goes on, if the siege continues, if it increases more pressure for negotiated settlement, we might have to start putting pressure on President Zelensky to accept something that, you know, maybe includes Vladimir Putin having control of the Russian parts of Ukraine.
This is a really challenging strategic situation. When you talk about a diplomatic solution, what would you give the Russians? What would you get? Would you
clearly no NATO?
No NATO, and that Zelensky has signaled that he's willing to accept. But would you grant them that they get Crimea. Eastern Ukraine, they get Crimea, they get what they've already taken? I don't know if Zelensky ever goes along with this, but would we go along with that? Right. Would we ultimately reward Putin for what he has done in Ukraine? Even if it's just giving him Crimea, which he took in 2014, giving him the Donbass, giving him what he took in 2014, do you reward the fact that he went in and devastated a country, did all that Donna described, committed war crimes, according to our own president? Do we ratify a diplomatic solution like that? I think it's a really tough one.
It's so difficult, Donna, because the alternative may be a level Ukraine.
Yes, that is the moral judgment that I think our leaders will have to make, especially when they sit down next week in Brussels. Look, George, I mean, we all should worry about what Putin will do next. We know that he's a thug. We know that he will come after you. We were attacked in America. We just still, we're not even talking about the cyber attack that occurred with America. He can still use cyber against the United States of America. He can use biological weapons. So I think it's important that NATO and our European allies and others agree on what the red lines are and stick to them, because Putin will go up against that line.
That's why I think the MiGs are even more important, right? The MiGs are more important from sending a signal to Putin of what we're not willing to put up with. And that's why I think we should do the MiGs, is to say, no, we're not going to go in there, we're not bringing American troops in, we're not going to do a no-fly zone. I agree with that. But give the MiGs to the Ukrainians to signal to Putin, we are not giving in. We are not going to agree to this, and we're going to up the ante on this for the Ukrainians to let them defend themselves.
Because it's about more than just Ukraine. Putin has very clearly signaled he's got Moldova in his sights.
Right.
He has the Baltics in his sights. This is not just about Ukraine. That's why a diplomatic solution that resolves Ukraine by letting Putin get something from this invasion is very dangerous.
Absolutely. Let's switch gears now. Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, the confirmation hearing set to begin. We're getting a taste this week of what they're going to be like.
Already getting a preview, and I think Democrats are bracing for this to be ugly. We're seeing a preview of the attacks from Republicans calling her soft on crime, calling her soft on sex offenders, even something that the White House sees as an asset, which is her time serving as a public defender, Republicans are labeling as a problem. But I think there's two things that Republicans admit. One, elections have consequences. And regardless of whether or not Republicans rally behind and support, which it is expected to be a small number, they're going to be able to push through Ketanji Brown Jackson without any Republican support if they have to. And the second thing is that she's qualified. And even Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell has admitted that she's qualified to serve on the bench.
But soft on sex offenders?
There's ugly and there's ugly, George. I don't think this is going to be real ugly. I don't think this is going to be Brett Kavanaugh ugly. I don't think this is going to be the ugly that we saw with Sam Alito with his wife crying in the front row. I think you're going to see some
Republicans. Haven't we already seen some of that with Josh Hawley?
Well, look, but that's one person, George. And we're going to see in every party, in both parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, you have people who are willing to push the outside edge of the envelope. We've seen that with Josh Hawley already in other instances on January 6th and other times. So nobody's surprised about that. But I don't think you've seen or heard broadly through the Republican Party ad hominem attacks. And when Mitch McConnell concedes that Judge Brown is qualified, well, then, you know, that kind of changes the whole dynamic. So, I think she will be confirmed. I think there will be some Republican votes to confirm her. And I think given that, it's not going to be nearly as bad as some of these previous ones have been.
Well, this is her fourth time before the Senate, and I think she will be successful once again. She had bipartisan support on the last three visits, and I think she will gain bipartisan support this time. We're on the threshold, as I said several weeks ago, of making history, along with President Reagan, President Clinton, President Obama, President Trump, now President Biden gets to put a woman on the court. It has taken us 233 years, but this is an exceptionally qualified woman. The American Bar Association has endorsed her. The Fraternal Order of Police have endorsed her, along with so many others. I just want to say on a personal note, this will be a joyful moment this week.
So, I mean, she's going to get confirmed, barring something entirely unforeseen, and she'll get a couple of Republican votes. I see at most three, maybe four. But the larger picture here is this will be the fourth straight Supreme Court confirmation that was essentially party line, but there was only token support from the other party. And when you look at the court that she will be on, you will really only have one justice that had an overwhelming confirmation, John Roberts. That's very different. I mean, throughout much of our history, Supreme Court confirmation, if somebody was qualified, the president had the discretion to put that person on the court. Now we're at a point where the court is politicized and all of the members of the court were largely confirmed by one party or the other.
What a position the Chief Justice has right now.
Yeah, look, I mean, you know, you get the big money, you gotta do what you gotta do. You get to sit in the middle. And decide how the court moves one way or another and assign opinions, you got a tough job. But look, I think that what we've heard from inside the court, from the justices, is that the collegiality inside those nine is much better than what it's portrayed in terms of the way the confirmations go. And that they do work well with each other. And I think when you saw the rumors that were out there about Justice Sotomayor and Justice Gorsuch, they both came out affirmatively and denied that stuff and
about
said
the masks.
Right, the yeah. masks and all the rest yeah. and said, we get along well together. We consider each other friends. I think Judge Brown, once she's confirmed, will fit into that same mold. She's a collegial person. She's worked with folks before. She's been throughout the justice system. So, you know, she's going to have a different opinion. But let's face it, if you're a Republican, you're replacing Stephen Breyer with Judge Brown. Same.
Former clerk.
We kept going right through the commercial here on the roundtable. That is all for us today. Thanks for sharing part of your Sunday with us. Tune in to ABC News Live this week for gavel-to-gavel coverage of Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson's Supreme Court confirmations hearings. And join us tomorrow on GMA.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.